Beyond Radley. Business, careers, and more. Virtual talks by experts from our community.
Thanks to the Radley team for organising this event, which we hope is going to be a celebration, maybe even a bit of a sales pitch for the many opportunities available to entrepreneurs and those who work for entrepreneurs or who support them, who are building innovative, sustainable and hopefully scalable British businesses. And a discussion on where and why we should be making in Britain is probably never been more timely. The debate around Chinese tariffs, the potential end of globalisation, ethical trade practices, use of sustainable materials, humane working conditions are all very much in the news at the moment. And actually today, the Heritage Crafts Association published its latest version of the Red List of critically endangered craft skills, and sadly, yet again, there are more skills that have joined that list this year. You're probably thinking that saving craft skills is a little bit niche, but I would argue that very often extinction happens right at the fringes of existence, and so some of the more viable skills that are on display this evening, from engineering through to brewing, might be next in line. I know the panel has got a lot to say on the subject, and we'll try and cover as much as we can in the next half an hour or so. But as Caroline mentioned, we'd be very happy to take questions and try and get a bit of debate going after our initial discussion. I am, as Caroline mentioned, MD of a company called Stone Britain. We are designers and makers of furniture, lighting, fabrics, wallpapers, all made in British workshops, and we hope that our workshops are incubators for passing on and scaling British heritage skills. We employ 48 of our own makers in workshops in Leicester and the West Country, and a little less than 70% of what we make is shipped to America. Delighted to introduce our panel of illustrious and hopefully passionate champions for British manufacturing. Rupert Gaber on my right, co-founder and executive chairman of Invest UK, has some of his DNA in British manufacturing, and also brings a unique insight to our panel on the all-important need to find and secure investment. And since 2012, Invest UK has managed over 500 deals worth over £250 million, which in turn have generated a staggering 10,000 British jobs. Next, Mike Curtis-Rouse, a leading figure in UK's space sector, particularly in relation to developing sustainable space operations. Mike is CEO and co-founder of Second Star, and if that doesn't sound intriguing enough, he's also head of in-orbit servicing, assembly and manufacturing at the Satellite Applications Catapult. Next to Mike, Sam Meakin, co-founder and CEO of the Gypsy Hill Brewing Company, as well as COO of Sunrise Alliance Beverages. Gypsy Hill is now London's largest independent brewer, and Sam has delivered industry-leading sustainable initiatives, including creating two carbon-negative beers without offsets, and on top of that, pioneering work with regenerative farmers. And lastly, Seb Inglis-Jones, co-founder and CEO of Maving, an example of which is at the back of the room. Britain's first electric motorcycle, manufactured in Coventry. Seb is on a mission for Maving to become one of the leading automotive businesses driving the transition to clean transport. So, moving on to our discussion. I wondered if, first of all, you could kick us off by telling us how your entrepreneurial journeys began, why Made in Britain is important for your businesses, and perhaps you could give us some examples of the skills that are employed in your businesses. So, would you like to start?
Cool, yeah, so I basically, completely by coincidence, ran into what turned out to be my co-founding partner when I was in a philosophy tutorial at university. And within about 6 months, we decided that we were best mates and that we wanted to start a business together for sort of different reasons. But the only thing we needed to agree was that it was in some way going to be combating climate change, because we thought that was the most important issue of our era. And if you're going to be devoting your entire life and sweat and energy and tears to starting a business, it would be good if that was something that was in some way helping. And then we sort of didn't think that we could start a business straight out of uni, that we should go off and kind of get some formal commercial trainings, went in our respective ways, me in marketing, him in finance. Anyway, eventually quit and embarked on the process of trying to find, you know, what this idea would be. I grew up loving cars and bikes, naturally sort of turned towards looking at the electrification of transport because it's quite accessible. I don't have an engineering bone in my body, much unlike the gentleman to my left and even maybe the brewer now. And so, yeah, the electrification of transport was quite accessible. And then I won't go through the full story of how we ended up on motorbikes, but basically discovered China's highest electric adoption that was all down to two wheels, and that basically what they've done is they champion removable battery technology. So the ability to just take batteries out of the EV, charge them in a standard socket, and that's how they overcame the kind of charging infrastructure challenge. Sorry, this is going on randomly a bit. UK. So yeah, then we basically realised that the problem with all of those products over there was that they were just built to a very strict price ceiling. There were kind of quality issues, not because the Chinese aren't fantastic at making EVs, they are, they're the best in the world at the moment. But just generally, you know, things are sold at a much lower price point there. So what we wanted to do was to harness the rich heritage that the UK has in the world of motorcycle design, that we've always been one of the top players, and to bring that to the table. So yeah, that was, what was the third element, Lucy, forgive me.
Tell us a bit about some of the skills that you're using in your business.
So flipping impressive engineers, essentially. So we've kind of, yeah, lent into, as I said, this rich heritage the UK has in the bike world. So very quickly we end up in Coventry and basically poached all of our staff from Triumph, which we view as the best motorcycle brand in the UK. I spend my life with very, very intelligent engineers. We do not have a kind of, you know, startup that's full of like 20-year-olds on beanbags. It's all middle-aged, Midlands engineers, introverted lads, very, very, very talented. And production team as well.
Sam.
Sure. Hey, everyone. I got into entrepreneurship because I had followed a route that I thought would be interesting. It was finance. I studied liberal arts at university in America and then got into finance after that. And while I was in finance, I thought that I would look into joining, like, investing in sub-Saharan Africa. I managed to get into that world and it was interesting. But after the best part of, I suppose, about 7 years of creating a sort of financial niche for myself, I realized I just wasn't very good at finance. That was an important realization, because once you get there, you're like, okay, so now what? I was talking to some guys earlier, and it's like, we've all got superpowers, so what's yours? And how can you map your career to whatever your superpower is? Because we have all got them. And if you can match those two things up, then incredible things possible. So I was like, well, it's not finance. It is, I think, and I'm still figuring this out, we'll spend our whole lives doing it. But it's a combination of leadership, vision, strategy, managing and working with people, creativity, and a few other bits and pieces. Quite a broad range of things. I felt like I was a bit of a jack of all trades. I was not good at any particular sport, but I was pretty good at all of them. So like that kind of thing. And I landed on brewing because craft beer was happening. It was 2014. It was 2013 actually when I started thinking about it, and craft beer was exciting. And I thought, I want to get into the mix on this and just outperform what's going on right now in the market. So competitive marketplace, but let's get in there and do a great job. And that's how I started off. I met a business partner, and between us, mainly him, but we had enough seed capital to get a very small brewery in a small warehouse together in South London. And we grew from there. In terms of Made in Britain, It's brewing. Our yeast is local, we grow it ourselves, our water is local, we filter it and treat it ourselves. Our barley is all local, we are lucky that we grow great barley in this country. Our hops, however, are from all over the world. We are bad hop growers now, which is a shame because we were great hop growers. But we're now bad ones. Maybe that'll turn around. But beer is an inherently local and much loved local product. Indeed, did you know cask beer is on the cusp of UNESCO protection? As it should be. There is no other country in the world that drinks warm, flat beer.
Sam, was there a time when all British beer was made with British hops? Presumably, yes.
Doubtless. Doubtless. Not even that long ago.
Yeah.
The American scene has really grown enormously, and the quality of American hops are very high. And really importantly, they're much better suited to this whole sort of IPA thing, which is what everyone is interested in drinking these days. So it's more like the hop market has been led a bit more by consumer tastes. I suppose if we all just drank cask beer and best bitter, there'd be no need for American hops. But that is where it's gone, and therefore we use them.
And what skills do you need to become a brewer?
Well, to be a brewer itself, my head brewer right now is a rough northerner called Jim, and he started off taking one of his 2 days off a week running a pub, cleaning barrels for us. And he stayed, and he's now our head brewer, and he's great. So, but we were talking earlier, and we said, breweries founded by brewers usually fail. And that is arguably true. So what does it take to run a brewery? Well, I think it does take someone who is astute enough to understand the value of brand, the value of good commerce and sales, obviously logistics. There's a manufacturing process which is like 50-50 between science, engineering, and the other 50 is like magic. Sorry, Mike, but it's true. It definitely takes an open mind, an open heart, and to start a brewery, a lot of collaboration, but it's a great journey. We'll talk about this more, I'm sure.
So, Mike, I imagine there's not much magic in what you do.
Space is pretty much full of magic. I'd say most of my engineers are, some of them lounge around in bin bags, some of them are on bin bags as well, and some of them drink, possibly to excess, but I'm not, and some of them ride motorbikes. So I started my career as I was going to be an RAF pilot, and I discovered I was blind, or at least I needed to wear glasses, so I couldn't fly jets. So the next option was the Army, and the Army didn't seem to like me because I had a philosophy of going on familiarisation visits and taking things apart, and apparently if you want to commission as an officer, that's not what an officer does, so you let the troops do that. I decided that was terribly boring, so I went and carried on with my degree, which was in robotics, which was relatively early, end of the last century, so you can gauge from where I am in that position. And then I kind of bounced around a variety of different organisations, but all big research organisations. So I spent 5 or 6 years working for CERN, playing with particle accelerators, and you can play with particle accelerators. Don't put the beer in them, they don't like that. You do a variety of things like that. And then I bounced to nanotechnology, so it was a really small science, and then I went to material science, and then I discovered I had a knack for software. But what I discovered, and in the same way that both Sam and Seb have talked about, is I had a knack for building teams of really smart people. Now, I'm not particularly smart. I know about that much about just about everything, which makes me really good, basically, in a pub quiz, but doesn't make me particularly useful in anything else. But I know a lot of smart people who do. So I'm good at basically finding those people, and that's probably my superpower, finding those people, blending them together, and at the same time identifying something which you can do. So my first startup was a company which basically was looking at sort of the dawn of 3D printers. Most of you probably have played with a 3D printer at a variety of levels. This little rocket engine over here was built by a very expensive 3D printer, which is currently on fire when I left the site earlier today, so that's a bonus. We developed a software which allowed you to basically calculate how to build rocket engines and other things without them going wrong. If you ever use a small plastic printer, they don't work very well. Big metal ones are just the same, they just cost more. And we ended up basically developing some software, and then we ended up selling that, exiting the company to, a variety of other organisations, including SpaceX, who bought bits of it. So that was a good journey, and then I discovered I quite like the entrepreneurship thing, but I also like paying my mortgage, which, when you spend all your money, you then can't pay your mortgage. So you know, another skill I clearly don't have. So I went into working with space companies and building infrastructure for other things. So that was kind of my journey moving into both what I do in Second Star, which is building rocket engines, a bit like that, but also bridging the technology gap and taking companies, UK companies for the most part, and helping them basically address the new frontier, the final frontier in many cases, well, at least when they succeed, which is space and what they can do there. And I work with a breadth of people with all different backgrounds. So some of them are the conventional, the mechanical engineers, manufacturing, electronics, but they're also finance. But at the same time, I have a whole bunch of guys and girls, for that matter, who have come from very different areas. So for example, the heat shields that we use for spacecraft, and we don't build them, but other companies do, one of the key technologies there is knitting. I mean, and you can be thinking, it's like, well, how does knitting relate to space? Well, you need fabrics, and actually spacesuits are the companies making spacesuits, and there's about five or six of them globally. Most of them are employed seamstresses, because that's the key skill. So actually, in a way, you see that some of the key skills we need for the future are very much wedded in the past. So that's very much where we come. And what the UK does really well is we do things to that high level of fidelity almost better than anyone else in the world. So if you want to build the best in class in terms of small satellites, or you want to build the best in class in terms of electric motorbikes, or the best in class in beer, I'm not a beer drinker, so I couldn't comment, but the UK is one of the best places to do it because we have fundamentally the right ingredients.
Hi. I'm really pleased that there's so many current students from Radley here, which is because that's really the reason I am here, because when I was at Radley, this was a long, long time ago, it was pretty bad, the careers advice and the careers management. So the mere fact that Caroline's organised this means that things have improved. The other observation I have is that when I was there, I was pretty rudderless, and I was always very envious of those boys who had very directional parents with very established careers in investment banking or whatever, and you go, that's right, this is what you do, these are the internships you need and everything else. So I really hope the people that take most out of today, this evening, are those people who are rudderless, because don't worry, there's a rudder out there for you, which goes back to this special skills point. It's there, and that's why these things are so important. The manufacturing thing is interesting, because the reason I was at Radley is because my great-grandfather made money in the Industrial Revolution, which I think a lot of Industrial Revolution families there. And up to the 1970s, about half of the UK GDP was in manufacturing. So you can imagine what it was in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And it's now 8%. So there's been decline in manufacturing, but my DNA, as it's referred to, but actually the money to send me to Radley, came from manufacturing. And we made whalebone corsets. And a third of the world's whalebone corsets were made by my family in Ashbourne in Derbyshire. So think of all those whales that perished. But also, one can look at the industrial story of decline, because, of course, the First World War came along and people stopped wearing whalebone corsets. So this business limped on enough to pay my fees. And my father was the last managing director of the firm and was known in the army as the Braharaja, because that's what they made. So the manufacturing story is in the DNA, and I'm really exercised by... Well, firstly, wanting to help you guys, particularly the rudderless ones. But secondly, about rebalancing the economy, because manufacturing has such an important part to play in the economy. And as I said, we're at 8%, but Germany's at 19% of their economies in manufacturing. And America's at about 12%. So there's a real need to go, and I hope we can get onto a conversation about why has that happened, because I think it is quite relevant, and how to change that perception. Now, part of the perception, from a careers point of view, because this is what tonight's about, is the entrepreneurial journey, and I'm an entrepreneur, I founded an investment business, and we invest in manufacturing, which is why I'm here. But that actually represents probably, well, less than half, I don't know the exact percentage, of the manufacturing industry, and there are, and there's no one here on the panel to speak to it, so I'll speak to it just for a second, really brilliant careers in what might describe as mainstream manufacturers, the household names that you've heard of, BAE Systems, Rolls-Royce, Jaguar Land Rover, all of whom have really brilliant graduate trainee programs. So when you're looking at the career, yes, look at the entrepreneurial journey, because that's most relevant for tonight, given the experience of the panel. But that does not mean it's not mutually exclusive to a really fulfilling career in mainstream manufacturing, where those career options do. And my last point on that is, I think one of the most, I did law, but one of the most fantastic degrees you can do, if you've got the right mind for it, is engineering. And then you have to resist the temptation of becoming an accountant, because I think 80% of engineering graduates go on to become accountants, whereas in Germany, 80% of engineering candidates go on to become engineers. And therefore, it doesn't become much of a surprise that 18% of their GDP is in manufacturing and 8% of ours. Is that enough?
Yeah, very good. So let's talk a little bit more about being an entrepreneur. You've all mentioned, Seb and Sam, you mentioned that you had a bit of a previous...
I was just taking that to be ready.
Yes, entrepreneurial path. But do you know if you're going to be a good entrepreneur, or do you have to have spent a few years doing something else before you realise that's the only thing you can do?
Then I will butt in, because actually you got me fired up, your point there about the importance of, you know, going on and getting a degree. I think that's so true. I think very few people are ready to start a business fresh out of university. I think it's probably a mistake. Obviously, people who go on and do it, you know, if you're thinking about doing that, you will do it, whether or not I say you do, because that's the kind of person you'll be. You'll be a classic, you know, Bill Gates style dropout, and no doubt, you know, make a billion-dollar company. But I think the better, more realistic way of going about it is, you know, going and spending some time in an office of some sort and getting some training from a, you know, whether it's, I went into the kind of fast-moving consumer goods world, so this is the companies like Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Nestle, you know, all the big brand companies that basically put all the stuff on the shelves of Tesco and Morrison's and the like. And through that, I learned sales and marketing, yes, but also just how to conduct myself in an office and how to speak to people of, you know, certain degrees of seniority. And it was only that gave me the confidence to then, you know, go and do what I eventually ended up doing, is making a motorbike company completely. I used to manage Vanish, the stain removal brand, and Durex, which you probably have heard of, and yeah, Finish, Sit, Bang, you know, weird things. But you know, building, I always knew I wanted to start my own company, but that was the way to it for me. And I think that whether that, yeah, that can be done in all manner of ways, whether it's through engineering or accountancy, so for some people. But yeah, very big fan of doing that. And then on the entrepreneurial thing, just in terms of qualities, I think resilience, determination, the main thing, you know, that ultimately makes an entrepreneur is just ignoring everyone else's advice to some degree and going on and doing something and sticking to it, even when every sign is that you should probably pack it in. And so to some extent, you won't, if you are an entrepreneur, you won't listen to what we say, you'll just go and do it, and that's how you know that you're the right person.
And Seb, I think, sorry, Sam, you also had a career before brewing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. I've kind of always viewed life, or I've read things that resonated with me that say you have three careers. And I think that's, I can see that being really true. I can see that working out for me. I had my first, I learned loads. I think you learn lots from good bosses, and you learn even more from bad ones. I learned a lot from a bad one, and it was really my bad one who inspired me actually to start my own business. So I was like, I can do this better, like, than this guy. You know, yeah, like, not in an arrogant way, but, you know, I thought I could. I'm doing this now, and there is no journey you will learn more from than running your own business. I've done an MBA, and that was like a pittance of learning compared to the last decade of running a business. And I'm really excited for what my third one is. I don't know yet. Guys already asked me outside, and I genuinely don't know, but I am excited for it, and it will be something that I will have, that will be added to from the last 10 years of running my own business and running beer and the previous career of being in finance. So, I'm excited for that. And if there was anything I would see on, I mean, definitely get experience, but most importantly, do something you're interested in. That you find, that you come away from being able to learn. Because if you're learning every day, you're going the right direction. And it does not matter how perfectly aligned the direction is with what you're doing. It doesn't matter if it takes 10 years to find your superpower, but just take something away from every day. And in the end, you will one day wake up and be like, huh, this is obvious, right? This is clear as day. It's obvious what I need to do. It's this. But that's, it's taken a decade to get there, but that's fine because you've learned every day. So that's just some it's kind of random thoughts.
I think also the other thing is that it's there are some young guys here that your working life is long, isn't it? So there's mine has been longer than yours, so there's plenty of time to get at least 3 careers under your belt, I feel.
Definitely. And it is long, and it's like it's not a competition to make the most money the quickest. That's actually a disaster, I would say. It's about investing in yourself through learning and making sure that you have, some slightly larger directions where you think you're going towards and stick to that and make sure you're happy while you do it. I mean, I'm a father of 4 kids now. and I'm like, I see my role as a parent is just to create happy, healthy 30-year-olds. Like that's it. Not happy, wealthy 20-year-olds or 24, whatever, like 30. Once you're 30, you're properly out. And it's just like, if they're happy and healthy by 30, you're good. But until then, you're just not sure. So it's a long old game and you should play it that way.
Okay, so let's talk about money, Rupert. I wondered if you could give us a quick overview of the climate for raising money in the economy right now. What are the options? And maybe the panel could then chip in with what's worked and what hasn't.
So my company is unique, but it is unusual insofar as we direct our get investment from international investors investing in the UK. And what makes it unusual is that the proportion of the investments, and this is over 500 investments, in manufacturing is about 15%, which is actually average. So that is the amount of money that goes into manufacturing is about 15% of all investments. But those of you who are awake will realize that only 8% of GDP is in manufacturing. So in other words, you need to put in more investment into manufacturing than the size of the company suggests, because manufacturing is what's called capital intensive.
I can see all three members of the panel nodding.
It's capital intensive. It uses more capital. What that has the effect of doing, so this is all a bit mathematical, but it's good for you. But what the effect is, though, that it dilutes the return on capital. So investors are looking for return on capital. Okay, because you're basically putting in more investment for less output, meaning you're going to get less return on that investment. And in fact, the average return on investment for manufacturing is about 8%. Whereas on tech, which is in theory at least very capital light, or certainly in the early stages, people obviously hear endless stories about the big win, the unicorn, etc. But down in the trenches, reality is the return on investment is 18%. Okay, so if it's just purely from a financial return point of view, you wouldn't invest in manufacturing, you would invest in tech. So why invest in manufacturing? Well, manufacturing has its unicorn moments. We have 3 unicorn moments sitting here on the panel. You're very lucky. We can tell your grandchildren that you were sort of panel of these guys before they became it. So unicorn stories do happen, but it should be much more enduring and much more survivable if it can get through the very difficult, capital-intensive early stages. So it's much more enduring, so that 8% return I was talking about can actually endure for far longer rather than a frothy tech thing that can be here today, gone tomorrow, or superseded tomorrow. So it's much more enjoyable. And then we talked earlier about innovative, viable, and scalable. So it's slightly harder to be innovative in manufacturing. One could argue the toss. I'm sure Sam will tell us why his beer is innovative compared to other people's beer. Okay, electric bikes, yes, I think that's a fairly obvious use case for innovation, and obviously space tech is off the scale. The viability point is absolutely critical, which is this capital employed point, and that's where Sam would probably win, because he'd say, well, people are always going to drink beer in recessions in whenever. And then scalability is how can you be that soar away success? And again, with manufacturing, hard to do. Once you do it, it becomes every bit as valuable as one of these frothy tech businesses. The final point, so I'm banging on, but the other point is about people. And we have a mantra on people, which I can see all the panel why they're investable, is first of all, as investor, do you like the person? And liking is really important, because the investor is going to have to sit around a boardroom table, and that's one of the things that parents are paying for at Radley, is to make you likable. Not some people are not likable, but most Radleyans are known to be likable people, and that really helps. And secondly, do you trust them? And most Radleyans are trustable. Some of them are trustees, or trustafarians. But anyway, are you actually trusted? Is the person telling across the table telling me the truth? Okay, is the point. But the last point, and forgive me who picked it up, but one of the, I think it might have been Sam actually, who said, is, are you a problem solver? Because 90% of the problems that happen in any business, whether manufacturing or not, are fixable. And the very worst thing is that somebody, as Duke Wellington said, that runs away at the first whiff of grape shot. So can you actually stick with it and find those solutions?
So that's very interesting. So I think you told us that manufacturing is not always an easy pitch to investors.
Well, it's because of the return on capital. It's very hard for me to show a financial model to an investor for a manufacturing business that goes off like a hockey stick. Mm-hmm. Whereas 2 minutes on an Excel spreadsheet, you can make a tech business do that instantly.
So who's going to be brave enough then to tell us about your scalable moment? And
I was going to have a grumble about how hard it is to raise money as a manufacturer.
I had some good bits as well.
Okay, give us a good answer.
Yeah, so I just illustrate that point a bit. You probably know the Snapchat story, the two guys who made this slightly questionable app and then got loads of traction for a use case that they hadn't come up with, and it was eventually called? 9 billion? Yeah, anyway. They turned down a $9 billion offer. But so the tech world where you can build a company with just like three people and a server, you can see why that would be very appealing to an investor. Whereas if you go, as I did with my co-founder, to an investor and say, can I have £1 million for a business that doesn't exist, with a team that doesn't exist, make a product that we have absolutely no credentials for, that's tricky. But I will say that when the first startup that I worked at was a company that was essentially, I won't bother telling you the name because it's dead now, but it was essentially Facebook events before Facebook events came along. So we put a lot of time and effort into making this product that did, actually, before you press, passe, isn't it? Facebook events, probably don't even know what that is. Anyway, Facebook events came, and overnight the whole company and product was completely redundant. So the sort of negative thing about tech is that you can lose your entire fan base just as easily as you can gain it. And the you know, whereas we found it really tough to raise money in the first instance, and it is really hard as a hardware business manufacturing. The nice thing is that we get to, when investors come and visit our factory, you can see a production line, you can see bikes going down, and you can see people making things, there's stuff, which is very sticky and appealing, and you can kind of wrap your head around it. Possibly not the complexity of the rockets, but so there's this point you get to, I suppose, where you've got quite a lot of stuff around you that then becomes maybe a little bit easier to invest in. And then I just was going to reiterate that point you said about Radleans being likable. So anyway, if anyone who does go down the kind of entrepreneurial route and is looking to raise money for a business, I know this might seem like it's quite far in the future, but I really do think that you'll find that the confidence that you've developed at Radley and all the kind of communication skills that it gives you, hopefully the likability, you will find you have a much higher hit rate of success when it comes to things like that, that you will be a much more appealing prospect. So, you know, sadly in some ways than some of the people who haven't had quite as good a leg up when it comes to kind of communication skills and stuff like that. So I was just going to reiterate that. I think it's an important point.
Thanks. We've just got a couple more minutes. Sam or Mike, would you like to just talk a little bit about experiences with the money people?
Yeah, we've crowdfunded. Crowdfunded seems appealing, I guess. And it was. We raised about 800 grand from the crowd in 2022. There are many avenues open to you, I suppose, when you are trying to raise money. And what your strategy is as a business should have a pretty big influence over the route you choose to try and raise money. On the manufacturing front, I think one of the advantages is you can provide cash flow much more quickly than a tech company can. And I think if I was to look back, it's lower risk, you know, from that perspective. So if I was to look back, I would have pushed my business to generate cash much quicker as a manufacturing business and actually not go for so much growth as fast as we maybe did. Because it's tough to scale a loss-making manufacturing business, right? looking back after doing it for 12 years. So, we've raised about 800 grand from the crowd, and that's been good. We've raised from angels, seed investors, almost raised from a bunch of VC investors, and now have ultimately raised via sort of partial MBO and have joined a larger independent group of brain businesses. So I've seen a gamut of different options that you can do in terms of fundraising, and maybe I'll just leave it with that if you are at the stage where you even want to know a little more about this, I'm happy to chat about it afterwards.
There's an interesting convergence between tech and manufacturing, and one of the interesting things about both tech and manufacturing in the space world is that actually your manufacturing often starts with a very low minimum viable product, and you know, very much echoing what Sam said of saying, it's about trying to sell stuff. But in the space world, it's much harder because you don't need that many of those things typically. But what the advantage you do have is that this kind of convergence of tech and manufacturing means that you often generate effectively a tertiary product, which often is data or something else. So that ability to basically end up with something you can sell, something you can offer and get to market as fast as possible. While it's exciting to build rocket engines and blow them up on a regular basis, even if your neighbours don't like you too much, you have to realise at some point that actually drawing a line and going, okay, it's good enough. Let's basically get some cash in the bank. Let's demonstrate to our investors that we can raise. Let's demonstrate that we can actually sell something. And actually that kind of point of having enough kind of tenacious drive to get to that point to recognise that there's that risk between growth and there's that risk between producing. Produce. Manufacturing isn't manufacturing without making something, and making something actually takes you a long way. I think one of the points, just in terms of those characteristics, and I certainly think it's an aspect that Radley demonstrates in abundance, is a combination of being tenacious, but also having the humility to learn. And you'll find that many entrepreneurs basically don't listen because they think they know best, or they've read it, seen it, they've watched it, they've listened to it, someone's told them. One of the greatest skills I think I've learned is however much I think I know, I can always learn, and there's always someone who will teach you something. Even, you know, whether it's a bad boss basically teaching you how not to do something, or whether it's the guy who's been cleaning barrels basically deciding now he wants a job working full time for you. Every person you meet will bring a lesson, and that's a lesson which sends you in one direction or another. But I think tenaciousness is a key point, but also recognizing basically, again, it's about likable piece. There's nothing worse than basically sitting in a room full of investors who all hate you. I haven't fortunately yet had that experience, but I've certainly sat in rooms where I've been an investor and I've looked at the company we're investing in and gone, we did what? I don't think you ever want to be that entrepreneur where the investors are looking at you going, you did what? Because that's not a good place to be.
Thank you. So interesting. A couple of things I'd love to come back to you on, but I think we're probably going to open the floor for some questions, if there are any.
Well, you guys are all here clearly because you've been successful in something you're doing at the moment. I'm a big believer that our failures define who we are and evolve our mindset. So what would each of your biggest failures be and what lessons have you learned from them?
I've got a cracking manufacturing failure story. We invested, in fact I was so excited, I invested as well, quite a lot of my own money, into cut flower businesses, okay, trying to do like Freddy's Flowers, that kind of thing. And we had, we bought a business, and the business also had flowers in hotels and offices and stuff. And I didn't understand that floristry, which I thought was a creative, brand-led business, is, of course, a manufacturing business. Because what this bastard, who sold me the business did, and I didn't realise, he had the contract to do the flowers in the Ritz. So you walk in the Ritz, and there's a big flower arrangement as you walked in. And that was at a fixed price, let's say £1,000 a week or £500 a week. And every week, he took out one flower. So every week, his margin on this increased by the value of one flower. By the time we bought the business, this enormous great thing with which he'd won the contract was down to a little posy on the table. And I said to the GM of the Ritz, I said, this is great news, we bought this business, it's going to be absolutely fantastic. He said, let me just ring the head concierge downstairs. What do we think of the flowers? He said, no, they're terrible. I said, well, I've got news for you, just lost the contract. And that was simply because I didn't realise that actually it was a flower arranging is a manufacturing business, which was the final point I want to make, which is connected to this, is that manufacturing is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I went for a kind of a sexy business. You could say that these are businesses are sexy businesses, but there's brilliant manufacturing businesses that are really unsexy. And a good example, for example, is defence at the moment, which 6 months ago everybody hated, and now everyone was, oh, that's good. Yeah, because there's really broad range of manufacturing businesses.
Anybody else admitting a failure?
Well, I was just going to go on a bit of a dive. Look, I mean, I very much do not feel like a success at all. And I think if you saw the inner workings of pretty much any business that's getting off the ground, and even one that's, I mean, even, you know, even the sort of huge publicly traded businesses that seemingly are just, you know, just generating billions for everyone who, but they're always on the knife edge and very close to failure. And you know, I began fundraising a month before COVID struck, and then that completely kiboshed the entire thing. I then negotiated our supplier terms during the supply crisis, which was a catastrophe. We then launched our first bike just as Russia invaded Ukraine. And it basically just everything, you know, and then just at the point where the US had become our largest market, and you know, it's like 70% of sales in March this year, Trump decides to play with the world's economy, and you know, and I'm sitting in the boardroom, you know, with people sort of consoling me, saying that you genuinely have gone through five once-in-a-lifetime events in the course of 5 years, and so I think there's this kind of temptation. You know, you hear all these podcasts and you see these very replete CEOs sort of looking very, you know, put together, but most businesses behind the scenes, everyone's failing all the time. Everyone feels like they're moments away from complete abject collapse, and everyone's going to be, you know, looking at them and going, oh, you're, you know. So I think it's very easy, particularly when you're young, to look at people in their respective careers and think that everyone's, you know, got it together. But I would really challenge that and to say, yeah, don't worry when you do fail, because you will fail all the time, and ultimately just come out the other side having learned something. You know, kind of like as Sam was saying earlier with you know, his finance career, didn't work out, but you know, I dare say that's why you're sitting here today. And I think that's what success is. It's just the ability to kind of weather those storms and sort of learn from them as you go.
I had another company called Puffin Systems, which was basically about making drones which could launch out of pods on the road and basically tell you if there was a traffic going up, etc. And there was a friend of mine who worked for Williams. It seemed like a great idea. We both love drones. Who doesn't love a drone? Basically, we came up with some great concept art. We built some fabulous models, a bit too much 3D printing. We had this great demonstrator. We took it to our investors. They loved it. And we then said, and they said, great, we want to introduce you to National Highways. We took it to them, and they said, it's really exciting, but we've already got a solution. We're like, what, has someone copied us? And they said, oh no, we just put cameras on top of poles. So for all our kind of ingenuity, we basically completely missed doing our market research, because sometimes it's the really obvious solution which completely you miss. And as an engineer, and I'm guilty of this numerous times, is, show me something shiny. There's a bike over there. I'm trying to work out how to steal a company or swap for a satellite. Show me something shiny and tell me there's a use case, and I'm almost certainly going to dive down a rabbit hole trying to come up with several other use cases, while next to it, there's probably a perfectly plausible, you know, something else which does the job just as well. So for me, the key lesson is basically be prepared to look around and kind of take that moment where you step back and look at everything else. Because there is that, or ask your friend, or ask your neighbour, or ask the lady or the guy who serves you a coffee and say, this is my idea. And when they go, yeah, but I've got one of these, take that lesson, otherwise you end up with, well, a camera on a pole.
Any other questions?
In the lead up to fundraising, how far along in the design process, or like the development process, how far along were you before you actually started?
So what we did is we basically, you know, we cobbled together $25,000, right, which was not a lot in the motorcycle prototype building world. The first company we came across said, quote, that's $290,000 to make a prototype, and I said, can you do it $25,000? And they actually said yes, which is great. It's easy to negotiate when you have no money. So what we did is, yeah, we made what's called a works like looks like prototype, which is kind of like something which is visually you might look at and you might go, oh, it's a working bike, but if you sort of, you know, look under the bonnet, it's just got a tangle of, you know, tangle of wires. Ultimately you just need something which gets people's excitement going, gives them an impression of what you want to ultimately build. Serves as a talking point for you to kind of unveil in a presentation. So that's what we did. But if you were to write it, you know, more than 5 months, it'd probably explode. Prototype,
Mike talks about minimum viable product. It's absolutely right. You launch your product to a very small audience who are hyper engaged. You hope they run with it, they tell their friends about it. You relaunch the product, because they're hyper-engaged, they devour it, and you go through a series of cycles like that with every launch is an opportunity to raise money from investors because you're showing track record. And at some point or another, you aim to scale up and you go down the pipeline from a very narrow audience to hopefully a larger one. You don't need to be much more than an idea. The further along you go, great. But if you're cash constrained, then just go as far as that cash can get you, and see where, you know, and see how far it can go. You don't need to be as far along as you think.
One of the great things about space, and we've made a point.
Yes, I want to
hear this. People will give you money. And it's not quite as good as it was in the last couple of years, but generally, if you've got an interesting idea, you want to make a gas station in space, you want to make space cheese, you want to, and these are examples, unfortunately, I'm giving you, these are things people have actually got money for. You want to basically make designer spacesuits, or you want a space station, you want to partner with Prada. Again, these are real examples where people have given up not just tens of millions, in some cases billions of dollars to do these things. Prada space station coming somewhere to an orbit near you soon. There is a lot of money out there. And one of the things the UK does really well, and I hope Rupert's organisation may fall into this category, but probably because I assume profit making at some level, probably doesn't entirely. The UK government's
hugely generous when it comes to startup grants and innovation and activities. So for my company, Second Star, the European Space Agency broadly gave us £160,000 in exchange for writing 4 reports. I mean, it wasn't that hard. I probably shouldn't say that on record. They'll be very angry at me. But broadly, if you've got a good idea and it's got a link to space, I mean, it doesn't even need a strong link to space. There's a company who also got £160,000 for having a dubious link between narrowboats and space. I still can't work it out. But they got £160,000. So you just have to dip into specific areas, and sometimes you can find that link. And again, it can be, you know, a very, very thin thread. But probably, I think the UK after the US is the most generous nation in terms of giving out research grants, investment from the British Investment Bank, the Infrastructure Bank, the MOD. I mean, defence right now is everyone's darling. If you've got an idea which involves a drone or a tank, basically you can get money for it. If it involves dressing a tank up, you'll get money for it. If it involves dressing the drone up, you'll get money for it. It's not hard. So actually, the first place to do is don't get money from investors. Why? Because you don't want to give something away, because when you get money from investors, they want something, not just a seat, and that's almost minor, if they want equity. So try and preserve the core of your company, your stuff, for as long as possible, and take preferably someone else's money in exchange for nothing. And most of the time, unless you've got a very generous family friend or parent, that's probably going to be the government.
I asked Sam something similar to this earlier, but how do you manage the doubts of your team or your own doubts to keep going or take the leap of faith to start your own business?
It's a good question.
I think this is where having a co-founder is really helpful. Okay, I'm just making that point. I think I would have quit. I think I've sort of probably come close to quitting about 30 times, but I think having a co-founder or surrounding yourself very quickly with a co-founding team is all, you know, you just sharing the burden among more shoulders is the way to go. And you need different energies in that kind of relationship. You know, you need someone who's detail orientated, you need someone like me who's just a sort of mindless optimist. And so that whenever, you know, one of you has a panic for whatever reason, the other person is able to kind of bring their sensibilities to the equation and go, no, it's not so bad for this reason at all. You know, maybe we can approach it this way. Surround yourself with good people
as
possible.
I entirely agree. So from an investment perspective, co-founders are really good, because not only does it give a breadth of skills, but finding co-founder is of course incredibly difficult, because you need these comparable skills that sit together, and quite often your best mate's actually a bit too much like you. So you've got to find that kind of person who is sufficiently different from a professional point of view to be actually good from a business point of view, but actually sufficiently close to you that you have complete, utter trust. And one of the tests is, would you go on a canoeing holiday with them? And canoes are useful things, because if you can't bear the thought of sitting in a canoe with somebody down some rapids, then you shouldn't go into business with them, because of course the other guy is going to save your life. The other thing from an investor's point of view is actually resilience. And one of the three personal tests I said about, you know, can you stick with problems? Of course, a problem could be that you get flattened by a bus. And if you're an investor and you've invested in an entrepreneur who gets flattened by a bus, you might have key man insurance or something, but that only gets you some of the way. But having a team, and I think two is the right number, gives this resilience to the investor as well as to the team.
And I'm afraid on that note, we need to wrap up this section of the evening. So thank you all so much. I love the fact that you've all got a well-rounded sense of humour, too, which perhaps something to do with being entrepreneurial. So thank you all.
Thank you for joining us. Check our channels for the latest news and events from the Radleyan Society.